Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 219. More Archetypal Dream Work with Roger Kamenetz.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I use that as a paradigm for saying that dreams deliver very difficult and perhaps personally unpleasant truths, that they offer warnings to us about our behavior. So, you know, I tell in the book how in my own dreams, when I see myself lying or acting like a hypocrite, then I'm being shown an aspect of my behavior that I really need to look at and I need to change. So that's the first kind of dream I talk about, what I call the warning dream.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Roger Kamenetz, speaking about archetypal dream work. Roger Kamenetz, Ph.D., is the Eric and Lee Sternberg Honors Professor at Louisiana State University and is also the recipient of the LSU Distinguished Faculty Award. He has a dual appointment as a professor in the Department of English and in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies. He's the founding director of LSU's highly successful Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing and the founding director of the Jewish Studies program. He's an award-winning poet and author of 9 books, including the landmark international bestseller, The Jew in the Lotus, and the National Jewish Book Award-winning Stalking Elijah. His latest book, The History of Last Night's Dream, Discovering the Hidden Path to the Soul, was featured on Oprah Winfrey's Soul series. He lives in New Orleans and works as a dream therapist. His website is http://kamenetz.com, and Kamenetz is spelled K-A-M-E-N-E-T-Z. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Roger Kamenetz, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here.
Well, I'm so pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you. As you know, I recently did a show in which I interviewed Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster about their work in Vermont on an approach that they call archetypal dream work. And I sensed that they were on to something important, but I had a difficult time getting a really good fix on what's distinctive about their approach. And of course, they mentioned you and your most recent book during the course of the interview. And so I wanted to follow up with you and get a clearer idea of what might be going on here. And I have to say, you've written a remarkable book that pulled me in right away and held my interest all the way through.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it. I certainly, it was quite a venture to not only to write The History of Last Night's Dream, but to experience what I had to go through to write it. So, it was really an effort of devotion.
Oh, sure. That really comes through, that your own personal journey. So I'm very much interested in your own journey with dreams, as well as whatever light you can throw on Bregman's approach. And perhaps we can move through the high points of your book, which is almost it kind of meanders in a way, and it's almost sort of a detective story in which you're trying to track the disappearance from, at least in the first part of the book, the disappearance from Judaism, Islam, and Christianity of the dream as a source of divine revelation. Am I stating that correctly?
I think you stated it beautifully.
Okay. Well, what put you onto that path?
The origins. Okay. So basically, a few years back, I guess back in 1990, I went with a group of Jews to visit the Dalai Lama and wrote a book about it called The Jew in the Lotus. And one of the things that emerged from that encounter for me was the emphasis in Tibetan Buddhism on the visual.
Yes.
You know, meditation on beautiful images and the use of imagery as a spiritual tool. And of course, the Tibetans are also great dream practitioners. And so, you know, I kind of began to ask myself, well, what happened to that in Judaism? Because, you know, I was a kid, I was really raised up, I guess it's getting to be an unusual education now, but I was basically raised on reading the Bible, and I was loved all the stories, and I was always taken with the stories of Jacob's dream of the ladder, and Joseph and his dreams and his dream interpretations. So, gosh, I wondered, well, what happened to the dream in Judaism? Because you don't really hear too much about it in actual Jewish practice. And so, comparing Tibetans to Jews, I began to think about, again, this question, is there anything like this in the West? Is there anything like this in our practices, in Judaism or Christianity, for that matter, in which the dream is involved? Because it seems so powerful to me, my own dreams, that I just wondered, well, what happened? You know, where did the dream go?
Right, right. And also, you talk about your work in guided daydreams with Colette,
right,
Madame Colette in Jerusalem.
Right.
And I've always found waking visualization very challenging, and and that frustrates me, because I agree with you that there's a rich vein to be mined there in terms of the visual imagery that's running just beneath the surface of our consciousness. And you worked really hard with her to kind of develop that talent. Maybe tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I probably have the same problem you did, Dave, because I really, in the beginning, I had a lot of trouble seeing anything.
Yeah.
And one thing that Madame Colette said that was helpful was sort of, if you think you saw it, you saw it. And it speaks to the fact that perhaps in the beginning these images tend to flicker by really quickly.
Yes, that's my experience.
So I don't know whether it was just the magic of what she was doing, the group setting, the fact that other people were doing it with me, and so I was being stimulated by what they were saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I just found that over time I developed that capacity more and more. And, you know, I'm really a word person, so I think that it was hard for me to develop in the beginning.
Yeah, I identified with that in your book very much, with your being a word person, and I'm very much a word person as well, and so I really identified with that whole journey. And you also make reference to the work of Robert de Sual as a pioneer in waking daydreams, and I was familiar with his name from my own training in psychosynthesis some years back. Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, that makes you a unique reader of my book, I think.
Oh, really? Nobody else had heard of him, huh?
Well, I'd run into some stuff about psychosynthesis earlier on from some friends, but, you know, I think it's somewhat esoteric for many people, although I think De Sual's a fascinating figure. And, of course, he trained Colette, and so I think that a lot of her teaching comes out of that, as well as out of Kabbalah, essentially.
Yes. Well, I was really stimulated by your discussion of your own struggle between the word and the image. And as I say, I really identify with that as a word guy myself.
Right.
And yet I really sense that the image is the place of greater depth.
Right. Well, I think that's true. And I think I guess I'm reflecting that it's both a personal experience because of our education. In other words, we clearly, you know, the mind, we begin with images, and then we're trained into language in our own personal development. And then it also seemed to me to be traced historically that obviously religion, like Judaism, begins with a whole series of dreams in Genesis, and then the dream basically disappears. So the textual record, or the Torah, if you look at the five books of Moses, seems to be showing what I call the disappearance of the dream.
Yes, I want to take you into the Genesis part, but before we go there, I noted in chapter 7 you mentioned attending the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Berkeley in 2003,
right.
And
right.
That was a kind of a pivotal meeting for you. I don't think you and I met, but I was also at that conference. I remember the presenters that you refer to, and right. I think I also was a co-presenter in one of the workshops.
Oh, okay.
So we Perfect. Might have seen each other in passing.
No doubt. Yes, I was very interested. You know, I can't say that I'm an expert on the entire panoply of approaches to dreaming, but I really was struck by what I saw at the conference, both sort of the range of people from, you know, obviously brain scientists to folks who were, you know, dreaming to end the war in Iraq. You know, so there's a kind of range of approaches, I guess you could say.
Yes.
I mean, they all interested me, but I think, you know, I actually am interested in the science, even though I'm pretty much not acting like a scientist when I do the dream work.
Yeah, yeah. So your book is as much a theological exploration as a psychological one. And
right.
you do focus on three key dreams in the book of Genesis, Abimelech's dream, Jacob's dream, and Joseph's dream. And
right.
you suggest that those three are somehow representative of some broader trends or movements. Why don't you take us through that a bit?
Well, basically, I'm doing a reading or interpretation, or in Jewish terms, a midrash on those three stories, which is quite a lengthy tradition. But what I'm trying to bring out are aspects of the dream that are already, I think, evident in Genesis, which I regard as our sort of our primordial book about dreaming, and that in a certain way we've forgotten. So I'm kind of making a point there that, you know, we haven't actually moved past Genesis. In fact, we've forgotten Genesis, and there's something in Genesis that maybe we can learn from. I kind of like to think that our ancestors weren't stupid.
Yeah. So take us through those three dreams and what their importance is.
I just want to mention it because I know as soon as you mention Genesis, you sound like you're a Bible-thumping fanatic, and I'm not. But on the other hand, I don't want to neglect a book that happens to, I think, have some richness to it. So the first dream that I talk about, the dream of Abimelech, is simply a story where Abraham and Sarah are wandering around, and they end up with this guy who I think we would consider to be like a tribal chieftain or warlord type character. And he likes Sarah, so he, you know, Abraham has said Sarah is his sister, and so he takes Sarah to bed with him, and he falls asleep, and God appears to him and says, "You're a dead man." And basically it's a warning dream. He's told, look, the way you're behaving right now is going to lead to your demise. And I use that as a paradigm for saying that dreams deliver very difficult and perhaps personally unpleasant truths, that they offer warnings to us about our behavior. So, you know, I tell in the book how in my own dreams when I see myself lying or acting like a hypocrite, then I'm being shown an aspect of my behavior that I really need to look at, and I need to change. So that's the first kind of dream I talk about, what I call the warning dream. You want to go on?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay, so the second kind, I just want to take a pause there. Okay, so for the second kind.
And I was making a yeah. note on my pad. So
yeah. Okay,
that's fine. Why I was a little slow to respond.
That's okay. That's all right. Silence is good. I'm going to say the second kind of dream that I thought was important was the dream that Joseph has. And, of course, most of us think of Joseph mainly as the dream interpreter. And, of course, the last six dreams in Genesis are all dreams that Joseph interprets by Pharaoh and the baker and the butler and so forth. But originally Joseph is a dreamer, and his very first dreams, he has a pair of them really, show him an image of himself that the world has not yet seen. He sees a sheaf of wheat standing upright, which is pretty hard to do if you roll up a lot of wheat, but he makes it stand. He sees it stand upright, and the other sheaves are bowing down to it. And, you know, he tells his dream, and his brothers get angry, and that's why they throw him in the pit, and there the adventure begins, which winds, you know, he ends up in Egypt. But But my point is simply that we can have a dream that shows us a pure image of who we are in an absolute sense. And another way of putting that is it shows us an image of the soul. And so I use that dream of Joseph simply to indicate that we can see an image of ourselves, not as the world sees us, but as who we are meant to be. And I think that that kind of dream is a really powerful sort of affirmation. You might say it's almost the opposite of the Abimelech dream. Instead of warning us about our flaw, it's revealing to us our essence.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Now, you know, sort of, I would say that, you might say, armed with these two kinds of insights from our dreams, that is, warning about our pathological side and an indication of our essential nature, we're ready to go on this journey. And the journey is an encounter with the divine, really, with God, with the angels, with in other words, with the whole realm of spirituality that exists as a deeper level of our consciousness. And so the dream that signals that for me is clearly the dream of Jacob and his ladder, because there we have a guy lying on the ground, and he sees a ladder between heaven and earth, and angels are coming up and down the ladder, and he sees God standing at the top of the ladder or beside the ladder. The Hebrew is a little ambiguous there. And God speaks to him and promises him, basically, that God will be with him wherever he goes. Now, what I take from that dream is simply the idea that there are two levels of experience. There's the ground and there's the heaven. There's the material world and the way we live in our waking lives, and there's this other world, which I guess, you know, Mark Bregman would call the archetypal world. And so our dreams are like a ladder. They lead us to an encounter and an exploration of this world, and in that world we can encounter images of the divine, which are palpable and which are powerful and which are experienced with a kind of emotional power and impact that can change your life. So that's, you know, those three dreams really are offering us an indication of how dreams can remind us of our faults, expose us to our essence, and then take us on a journey.
Later in the book, you talk about the three gifts of the dream.
Right.
And they really sort of mirror what you've just said, right? In slightly different words.
Exactly.
Why don't you restate that for us, the three gifts?
The three gifts of the dream, I think really the same idea, basically, that, mm-hmm. that they show us, they warn us of our faults, they show us our essence or our soul, and they lead us into encounters mm-hmm. with the archetypes. When we start talking about archetypes, we're kind of borrowing a Jungian language, and we're beginning to talk about how the soul can enter into a relationship with beings, I guess, in our dreams that have the power to teach us. And so that's the whole discussion, I think.
Yeah, that's a very interesting discussion. And in fact, I may say you guys, referring to the folks at North of Eden, Mark Bregman and you. And
well, I'm absolutely one of them, and you know, I do dream therapy and have been doing it for a while with clients under Mark's supervision, and I feel very close to what they're doing, although I live so far away.
Yeah, and you know, based on reading the book, and I sat in on one of their webinars yesterday with Krista Lancaster and Anne-Marie Scavo, right?
Marie. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm persuaded that there's really deep, important therapeutic work that's being done there.
Right.
And at the same time, I think some of the struggle for me was that, in fact, there were Jungian terms and other terms that were being imported, but used somewhat differently than you know, than I was familiar with them traditionally. So it's taken me a little while to kind of figure that out. I think I'm beginning to get a grip on it.
Right.
And one of the things that, quotes, you guys do is your anti-interpretation. And I wrestled with that a bit because it seemed to me in some ways interpretation was a bit of a straw man that
right.
most of the dream workers that I know don't really do interpretation in the way that that you are being critical of. And,
right.
And so I found that, for example, in the book, when Mark responds to one of your important dreams with the comment, "You lost your father."
Right.
You know, the reaction to me, well, was, how is that not an interpretation?
Right. Well, I think you probably have a good point, and it is perhaps a straw man. I think it's a difficult issue because, you know, part of the context was the struggle, you might say, between, you know, this whole interpretive tradition, which is rabbinic, essentially, which takes the text and interprets it, and overlaying that into Freud, who I also see in many ways as having a kind of rabbinic approach to the dream. So, obviously, in the simple sense, any response to a dream is an interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're quite correct. What I really think the discussion, probably a better way of putting it is simply this, that when Mark said something like that to me, his aim is to produce an effect. More than to give me an insight. And so the drama of the session and the drama of finding an opening with a person so that they can essentially give up or discard old ways of thinking in order to feel in a new way is really the point. Whereas, you know, when people come to you with their dreams, so often what they really want is simply a kind of solution to the riddle. Oh, what did this mean? They don't really want to change themselves. And so I think anything you do in a session that helps a person feel more deeply or open up to change is valid, even if formally it is an interpretation.
Yeah, I'm getting the impression that Mark has a gift for making very direct, powerful statements about the emotional meaning of the dream.
Well, I think anyone who wants to change people has to have the chutzpah to at some point to confront.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very often, and again, I don't really have a survey of all the different therapies in the world, and I'm not claiming that I understand. You know, I can't offer you a synoptic or comprehensive view and say, well, this is the best. All I can say is it's the best I've encountered in terms of working with people and changing them that I've seen personally. So that's really all I could offer is testimony there. I think his approach is very brave. I think it's honest, and I think it's risky in the sense that you know, people may react and say, okay, I don't have anything to do with it.
Yeah, you talk about amelioration. That's a word that I think both
right.
you and Mark use. And
right.
I'm not totally sure I understand what you're getting at there. I think
right.
it's referring to a sort of lighter approach to the dream.
Right. Well, the term amelioration comes directly out of my study of, you know, one of the questions I had was, how is it that the in particular the Jewish tradition, how did it handle this heritage of the dream? And one of the things that the rabbis did when they began to consider the dream was they brought in this concept of amelioration. And it seems that amelioration was a ceremony. It is still practiced among some Orthodox groups, but essentially dream amelioration is a ceremony in which you come to a group of three people and you say, you know, I had a dream and it disturbed me. And they recite certain psalms, and then they say it's for the good. And that's it. It's not an interpretation at all. It's
mm-hmm.
simply, and
it's a ceremony to make you feel more at peace with it.
Exactly. So, to me, this points to something really significant, which is that dreams are terrifying, you know, and that people can't always handle the content of their dreams. So they go to an interpreter, not so much to to deepen their experiences or to feel the pain more deeply or the fear more powerfully. They come to have the dream ameliorated. And I think that model amelioration, which is, you know, I'm borrowing from the rabbinic text, is actually the model for a whole lot of the way in which people deal with dreams in the West. That was my contention. That's really what I'm saying.
Yeah, so what I'm getting is that the heart of your work is that is a very strong intention for it to be therapeutic, both therapeutic right. and spiritually transformative, and
right.
and that you don't want to just kind of mess around on the surface.
Exactly. And I think that the work, I think that Mark's leadership and Krista's and the others who do the work, and I've learned to do this in my own practice, and it hasn't always been easy. It takes a lot of chutzpah, it takes a lot of guts to sort of say to somebody, you know, this dream indicates, you know, I'm seeing here that, you know, you're really terrified of your husband. Or, you know, whatever. You know, so mm-hmm. I don't get too many examples, but the point being that to say the truth, not because I'm saying it, but because the dream is saying it, that there are certain moments in a dream that are so existential and so powerful that my job is simply to stand with the dream, behind the dream, and deliver that, amplify it. You know, is this how you feel about your life, for instance? Or is this how you feel when you're with your husband, you know? Because in the dream, that's how you feel.
Yeah, I'm very much on the same page with you there. You know, I think we're in strong agreement that dreams don't lie, and they present a very candid picture of the inner situation.
Right. And they do it in such a powerful language. And I guess I feel whatever I bring to this, because I'm not, you know, I'm a totally, you know, untrained. I have no degrees in this area. I'm a poet, I'm a writer, and a professor, but I'm certainly not I have no psychology background, period. But I do think I have some feeling for images based on, you know, having been working with imagery since I was 15 as a writer and feeling images. So I know how images feel, and I think Mark has that gift to a huge degree, and I think that's really part of his excellence, I guess, in terms of what he does.
Well, also, you know, it's clear that you've done a lot of inner work, and so I think that that does qualify you to do what you're doing in addition to the other things that you've cited.
Well, I'm going to put your endorsement on my website.
Okay. Okay.
No, I'm teasing. But I you know, I think this question about interpretation really cuts into the notion of how we handle things in the West, where we tend to intellectualize and rationalize, and you know, we want to know the truth, but only in order to say the truth and not in order to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me have you try to give us a overview of this approach.
Okay.
To the extent that you can kind of break it down and
right.
tell us what the
okay.
key concepts are and so on.
Right. Well, I'm going to give you a simple idea of it, obviously, and it's, you know, just anyone listening to this, just realize that there's a lot more to it than I can say in the time we have. But
certainly.
But basically, you know, and there's a lot of information on the North of Eden website, too, about all this. But basically, you know, we take the client's, we follow the client's dreams. I mean, the basic format is simply this. I meet with the client for an hour. They send me their dreams in advance. I usually go over two or three dreams in a session. We work the dreams, which basically involves getting the client to feel more deeply the feelings in the dreams. We definitely stress the feelings. And at the end of the session, give a client a homework which is based on some moment, some powerful image in one of the dreams. Mark puts it quite well that in every dream there's a door, and you kind of push at that door. So sometimes the client has pushed the door open a little herself, and other times the client has just stood before the door, and you have to say, well, now open it. You know, so it depends on the dream, but by door, he simply means an opening to the next experience, the next level of feeling. And that's the basic format. Now, in terms of...
Well, say a little bit more about the homework, because right. I'm interested in that concept. I know from, for example, Robert Johnson, a book I use in a course I teach on dreams.
Right.
He has a four-stage process, and the fourth stage is something that he calls ritual, which is the idea to
right.
do something in the world
right.
with the dream to kind of bring it into.
Right.
So say a little bit more about the homework
right.
and how that's structured.
I'm familiar with his book, too.
Okay, good.
And there's a kind of, it's an okay approach, although I think the warning for me was you have to be careful not to fetishize your dreams and aestheticize them. And sometimes in that work, I see a little bit of that. So that's a concern of mine. But basically, the idea of the homework, I think, is to remind the person that he has or she has an inner life, because we forget almost immediately. And we go back to our daily concerns and to our external issues and to our work and to our parents, our children, our spouses. The homework is a place in your dreams. So you're going back to this place in your dreams. You're feeling just briefly the feeling, and that's it. And by focusing on a moment and a feeling, an image, you are able to refresh the work, and it goes deeper. Very often, the issue that you're focusing on becomes opened out in more detail in the next session.
So as I'm your client, then,
right.
would my homework consist of me trying to imagine myself back into that feeling place in the dream, maybe journaling
right.
about it, touching it several times during the week?
Some people do that. They write poems, they make drawings, and so forth. But honestly, what I encourage them to do is just real quick, once an hour, go there and then let it be. Because a lot of times... the work is unconscious. The work is underneath, and too much application of. I mean, it can be good for some people to engage in what you're talking about, because it just that's another way to deepen it. But for others, that becomes an occasion to, I don't know. I guess I was saying aestheticize it.
Mm-hmm. You said once an hour?
For a second. You're only there for a second or two.
So, in other words, through the course of the day, you're. Touching in on it.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Very briefly.
Yes, yeah. And so going into it a bit more deeply here, we've mentioned that there's some vocabulary that's developed around this. And, for example, animus and anima are used, but maybe
right.
in a slightly different way than they're used by Jung.
You're quite right. And I tried to address that in the book because I'm certainly aware of it. All right, so what we're saying is animus and anima. Now, in Mark's work, in Mark Bregman's work, animus and anima are two archetypal figures, the male and female archetypes. They appear in our dreams to have relationship with us. They have different capacities and functions, but their main purpose is to encourage the development of the soul self, and they do that through relationship with us, and they have different techniques. The animus, the male, tends to be more of a trickster figure, more playful, more assertive and aggressive. The anima tends to be more supportive and emotionally warm. They can work together. I believe Mark theorizes that ultimately they are really the same, but we're so hung up on gender that we see them in separate modalities. But you'd have to ask him about that, because he knows a lot more about it than I do. He's thought through this in a way that I haven't.
Okay.
But that's more or less the back of the envelope take on the animus and the anima. How that differs from Jung, we could get into, but I would really just say that he's using the terminology in his own way, and one of the main points is that I believe that initially, and you can correct me because you probably know tons more about Jung than I do, but I believe that initially Jung conceived the anima as an aspect of the person's, of the male's soul self.
Right.
And the animus as an aspect of the female's soul self.
Right.
That's not at all the way Marx sees it. And not only is the soul self, it's possible that the soul self can be both male and female in different dreams, but the anima and the animus are independent of the individual and have their own ontology, I think you could say. They have their own personality, which is uncanny. I mean, here we get into the area of how, you know, where the theology meets the psychology,
right,
and what different people believe about this. And, you know, it's extremely fraught and maybe could cause arguments. But when it comes down to your own dream, there's no argument.
I guess the question that you're raising is, mm-hmm, are these in some way outside entities?
Right.
Or are they projections of some inner self?
Right. You know, let me make a comment based, and maybe it'll sound like totally out of left field, but that's okay. When I first encountered Tibetan Buddhist meditation practice, and I remember talking to a meditator and trying to understand what's going on when you're meditating, and you see the deity, and the deity kind of comes off of the, you know, of the mandala, and it's floating there, and then it, as you meditate and visualize it more and more, it has a kind of reality, and you begin to, you know, focus on that, and you take it inside yourself, and all sorts of things happen. And I said, well, isn't it just projection? And he said, yeah, it's projection, but you know what? It's more real to me than any relationship I have with anybody in the waking world.
Mm.
Many of our relationships that we think of as real are actually 90% projection also.
Right, right.
So we shouldn't discount projection and say projection's unreal. Projection's a phenomenon that we can understand through our dreams.
Yeah, I think most therapeutic approaches today, or a lot of them, really look at owning and reclaiming our projections as a key part of the work that needs to be done.
Absolutely. And I think that when we realize how deeply we've been wounded and how, because of those wounds, we are unconscious of our projections, then, you know, simply by owning our own pain, owning our own difficulties, we can stop projecting them onto other people and making them the bad guys. And I think that's a whole piece of this work that I find really powerful.
Yes. Yes, a term that you use is pathology,
right,
which in some ways seems like it might correspond a bit to Jung's concept of the shadow. And at first I kind of bridled against that word pathology.
Right.
I guess because it sounds so negative and judgmental, and
right,
I guess we're all trying to get away from that in a way.
Right.
But it does attest to how sort of deeply therapeutic you see the mission of the dream work being.
Well, and also I think deeply moral. And I think that one of the things I like about Mark is his honesty, and I think the term pathology is harsh and difficult. And yet when you're trying to get people to face, you know, to peel back their lies and self-deceptions and delusions and say, look at this. This really is pathological, what you're doing here. Or this, you know, look how painful that is. That's the right word. And, of course, it comes from Jung. I mean, he speaks of pathology as a medical man. Of course, it's a perfectly good medical term. It hasn't acquired in medicine all the negativity that we've given to it. But I also think he uses it almost therapeutically to remind people that this stuff is something to be averse to. And I think his approach is different there, because one of the things that begins to happen is, as the pathology gets personified in our dreams and begins to appear as a separate personality, it's no longer just what I think and what I do usually, you might say, but becomes a separate personality. It might be a brutal father or a very harsh old woman. It might appear as an animal, like a crocodile, a snake, or, you know.
Yes, and you have wonderful examples of all of these things from your own work in the book.
Right.
I should let people know. For example, I'm remembering Gravel Grandma as an example of that.
Well, that's a dream where my daughter was on the porch, and this woman, old woman, was sneaking up on us, and we heard the sound of her walking on the gravel, and I immediately chided my daughter, and really that was her operating in me, the grandma operating in me. So the pathology can be in us in an unconscious way, that is, we act it out unconsciously, or it can appear in a dream as a separate figure. And when it begins to do that, we need to develop an aversion to it. Mark calls it an allergy, which means, I think, a visceral aversion. And it is harsh. It is Manichaean, I guess you could say. It is dynamic, and it isn't saying, oh, everything's good and has to be reintegrated, and, you know, these parts of us are also important and blah, blah, blah. But no, it's not saying that. It's saying these parts are destructive. They are dangerous, and they are trying to destroy the soul. And I think that aspect of Mark's approach is probably very controversial. And I can see where a lot of people would find it very difficult to accept.
I gather that he must have the ability to walk the tightrope of being able to sort of put your finger on the pathology to say, this is pathology, while at the same time somehow communicating support for the person and not blaming them.
He absolutely does, because he stands with the dream. So it's not Mark saying this, it's the dream saying it. And that's the feeling you have. And I think that, it always reminds me of one episode in The Sopranos, which, of course The Sopranos is all about Tony seeing this psychiatrist for years and years and never really getting anywhere. And at one point, Mrs. Soprano is sent to a psychiatrist who basically says, your husband makes his money by killing people, and so I can't accept you as a patient because I'd be accepting blood money. And I don't know if you remember that episode.
Yeah, I think so.
I always thought, wow, that guy's honest.
Mm-hmm.
That guy's for real.
Yeah.
You know, and that guy is profoundly moral. He's not saying anything goes. He's mm-hmm. saying, wait a minute, you know, this is what you're doing, and you're making a choice here, and you either choose this way or that way, but I'm not going to beat around the bush with you and pretend that what you're doing right now is a good thing.
I find people really respect that sort of honest confrontation, that it can really draw them in.
I respect it, and I try to live it out, but I agree with you that if there's any... The other thing that's fascinating about doing this work, you know, from the other end, that is working with clients, is if there's any smidgen of your own judgmentalism, of your own blame casting or guilt or whatever, and that gets in there, you've contaminated the session.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be really doing the work yourself if you're going to do the work with other people.
Definitely. So I gather this approach is called archetypal dream work because the archetypes are taken as very real, powerful, living entities in the psyche.
Right. I think that's why Mark calls it that, and I think it's a good a name as any. It might confuse some people because I believe James Hillman also uses that terminology, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, It basically does convey the significance of the journey to the archetypes, the journey of Jacob's dream, essentially.
And the idea of immersing oneself in the archetypes evidently leads to very deep and painful work.
Right.
And you hint that it can get close to madness. So
right.
I want to ask you, do you think there are dangers here? Is it for everyone?
I haven't seen anyone damaged, but I think that people tend to self-select, and they drop out of it when they feel it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think, I just can't say that I've seen any examples, but I could conceive of it.
Yes.
And I think you're sensitive to it. I mean, most of the clients I've worked with personally have been through so many therapies and so many different approaches by the time they get to me that they've kind of shaken that out.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly don't think someone should read my book or read Mark's book and try to do it yourself.
Yeah.
Wouldn't recommend that.
I listened to your interview on Oprah Winfrey's Spirit series. And
oh,
you,
wow.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. And you started to tell a dream, and she cut you off and switched to something else before you had a chance to say what it meant to you.
Uh-huh.
And it was a sort of dream that I identified a lot with, so I wanted to hear the wrap-up. I later did discover it in the book. But it was a dream in which you were supposed to be teaching, and the students weren't paying attention.
Right.
And I've had that sort of dream myself, so that's why I really perked up and wanted to hear you finished talking about it, because you said you saw it as something more than simply an anxiety dream, but you didn't get to say what that was.
Right. So basically, I was trying to explain that the work is a journey, and therefore, you know, very often we'll have a repetitive dream. And what I found important in working with Mark Bregman is that he had this ability to actually change that repetitive dream by ultimately seeing that the dream is trying to change you. And so in this particular case, I kept dreaming that I'd walk into a classroom and I didn't know what the subject was I was supposed to be teaching. I should add that I'd been teaching for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The students would ignore me, and I thought I would be rather cleverly solve the problem by throwing out different thoughts and ideas and see how they react, so I'd figure out what class I'm teaching. And it doesn't work. They just ignore me, and they begin walking out and so forth. And I felt a great deal of anguish in having this dream. So Mark's approach was basically to say, how do you know you're the teacher? To which I reacted, and I said, well, of course I'm the teacher. I've been teaching for 25 years. And I calmed down a little bit, and he said again very gently, well, does anyone in the class say that you're the teacher? And with that approach, I began to see that, in fact, I simply assumed I was the teacher, but there was no, based on the evidence, there was no proof that I was the teacher. And so the homework was to see myself in the classroom and imagine, to push through this door, okay, which in this case was walk into the classroom, but realize maybe you're not the teacher. So that was the homework.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that homework, I began to meditate on not only the homework, but the whole approach. It wasn't about my being a teacher. The dream wasn't simply that superficial. It was really about my attitude towards others, and that the arrogance of assuming that in any given confrontation or encounter, I'm the teacher. And that, you might say, automatic attitude is really pathological. And it's full of pride and arrogance. And so I felt the pain of that, and I began to work with that, and it had a lot of ramifications for a lot of my relationships, not only in the classroom, but in the world.
Sure, sure.
And as I worked with those feelings over time, I got another dream in which I walked into the classroom and I sat down with the students as a student, and then the teacher walked in.
That's wonderful.
It was wonderful.
And it really shows the progression of dreams and how they can, how you've kind of entered into a kind of another phase there.
Right. And, it was giving up. It was a kind of, Mark talks about dying to self. And in a sense, the teacher has to die so the student can be. And so even though I had a whole lot invested, as you can imagine, in being a teacher, because after all, I've been teaching for 25 years, 30 years now, I have degrees, I have students, I have awards, blah, blah, blah. The dream is saying, you know, in a fundamental way, your true self is not the teacher, the authority. Your true self is more like the student. And if you really want to get anywhere in this work, that teacher personality has to die and be replaced by the student.
You know, this causes me to wonder both how you first heard about Mark's work and
right.
then the possible struggle, and this could all be my projection as mm-hmm. as a co-professor.
Right.
But how, what was there a struggle for you to, quote, humble yourself
right.
To have this sort of very non-academic guy
right.
without a bunch of credentials and so on work with
right.
you so deeply?
It was a huge struggle, and I mean, in a certain way, he was the perfect teacher because of that. I mean, I'm a professor. He's not well credentialed. I consider myself very articulate and well read. I felt that, although I think he is actually very well read, I didn't think he was very articulate. So I kept stumbling on all of these objections that I had to him.
Yeah.
And of course, to give them up in each case meant to give up my pride. And that was a very good thing. So he became a great teacher for me because he was, in a certain way, the antithesis of what I thought a teacher would be.
Mm.
And it definitely, you know, I try to talk about that in the book as much as I can. And, you know, definitely, yeah, I was humbled, but I think more importantly, he was gracious, you know, in terms of putting up with all that.
Great, great. How did you hear about him in the first place?
I was living in Vermont at a place called the Vermont Studio Center, where I was kind of a spiritual guide in residence or some such thing. And I have a friendship with a guy named Lou Albert, who is a painter and a Buddhist meditator. And I told him that I was working on a book on dreams and that I was going to fly to Copenhagen to visit with a Tibetan dream master. His name was Tarab Tolku. And he said, well, I have a dream teacher. And I said, well, really? Where is he? He said, well, he's in Morrisville. Well, Morrisville is like this little town 8 miles away. So I was astonished. You know, I thought, wow, here I am flying to Copenhagen, and there's a teacher in Morrisville. And then I said, well, is he a psychologist? And he said, no, he's a postman. So in a certain way, that appealed to me, you know.
Yeah.
I guess I'm a bit of a rebel, and I thought, wow, a postman. Now that's really interesting.
You know? And he's going to deliver a message to you.
Maybe. You know, it says in the Talmud that a dream unread is like a letter unopened.
Right.
So maybe he would. But, the other thing was, I think, in my arrogance, I thought, oh, well, this guy will be very entertaining, and he'll be a nice little chapter in my book, and he's probably some kind of crank or something. And, of course, I describe in the book how in the very first session it completely blew me away. So, it was the beginning of my education.
Well, that's wonderful. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, Roger, and I wonder if there's anything more that you'd like to add before we wrap up here.
Not really. I appreciate, you know, you having read the book thoughtfully, and, I hope that, I don't know, I guess people could certainly visit me at my website, Kamenetz.com, and if they can spell Kamenetz.com, which is not so easy, but in any case, I appreciate the chance to talk with you, Dave, and good luck with the work you're doing.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to be recommending your book to all of my friends and also to my listeners. So, Dr. Roger Kamenetz, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Roger Kamenetz as much as I did. As you heard me say in the interview, I was hungry to get a better understanding of the archetypal dreamwork approach espoused by the North of Eden folks, Mark Bregman and Krista Lancaster, who I interviewed on Shrink Wrap Radio number 112. So I sat in on one of their free webinars, which was led by Krista Lancaster and Susan Marie Scavo, And by the way, my apologies to Susan Marie, who I think I referred to as Anne Marie during this interview. Hearing Krista and Susan Marie's accounts of their personal work, combined with reading Roger's book and now the interview, which you've just heard, I now think I have a pretty good grasp of their approach. Now, this is just my take and in no way an official representation of their work, so I apologize to them ahead of time for any misrepresentation if I get any of this wrong, but let me take a shot at it. In their view, we early on become estranged from our true selves. This is probably due in part to socialization by our parents and the compromises we make to fit in and to be accepted. It seems to be part of the human condition, and therapists from a variety of perspectives probably hold a fairly similar view, though they might express it differently. For example, Jung talks about this, I think, when he talks about our false self in terms of the persona, and that we end up discarding important aspects of ourselves, which we fear are unacceptable, and those go into what he calls the shadow. Bregman and company start from the assumption that our dreams come from the undiluted true self and give an accurate description of our inner life and particularly of where we are stuck, or what they refer to as the predicament. The predicament that we are locked in, that keeps us stuck, is seen as unhealthy and, as you heard, is labeled as the pathology. The predicament is likely to contain emotionally painful material. We will tend to resist really going into the painful pathological areas, and certainly resistance is well understood by many therapeutic traditions. Their take on resistance is a bit differently nuanced, though, I think. Instead of talking about it as resistance, they refer to it as the opposition. And I have the impression that at least to some extent they see the opposition as an archetypal energy that is often personified by some dream figure. This is almost a sort of enemy figure in the dream, though it may not be obvious. It seems to me that, at least in part, this might have elements of what Jung referred to as the shadow. Rather than breaking the dream down into a lot of individual associations or interpretations, the archetypal dream therapist is listening for the central emotional message of the dream, what the dream is saying about the dreamer's current situation, not so much about the dreamer's outer life as about their inner life. As you heard, homework is an important part of the approach. To get the dream client to stay with the dream images and feelings throughout the week, to get more deeply in touch with the force and reality of the underlying emotions. I have the impression that the archetypes are taken as real, independent entities to be reckoned with. The child is an important one in their approach. The child, in a dream, is seen as representing the natural, true self. Animus and anima are also important, as you heard Roger touch upon. The mother and the father are also key archetypes and I believe are seen as aspects of what they would call the divine or what others of us might call the higher self. For those who pursue dream work over time, they see it cycling through three main phases, perhaps at ever deepening levels. The first phase is revealing the predicament or the personal mythology of what's true and not true. The second phase is one where the client is beginning to separate from the false self and the true self is emerging. There is a dying to the old self. The third phase is one of greater commitment and congruence with the true self and an alchemical connection to the divine. These are not stages imposed by the therapist, but rather represent a natural unfolding of the dream work process. This seems like a useful and powerful model to me. It certainly makes sense in terms of other approaches I'm familiar with that seem to have similar elements. I think the North of Eden group brings a unique sense of community, passion, and mission to the process, which has given it a kind of transformational power. As they talk about the sorts of inner work and transformations they have personally experienced, it sounds like the real deal to me. If you are intrigued to learn more, I encourage you to go to the northofeden.com website, as well as Roger's website at http://k kamenetz.com, and I heartily recommend his book. It stimulated me both intellectually and emotionally.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, everyone out there in podcast land. I'm back. It's been about 2 weeks, and of course, I should be saying that I'm freshly back from my trip to Kauai. Guess what, though? I ended up not going. My friend, Dr. Ronald Alexander, who went over there ahead of me and who I was going to be hanging out with, got a bad ear infection while he was there. And given the discomfort he was in, plus a couple of other factors, I decided to cancel the trip. Even though it was my decision, I have to say I felt a bit down for a while, not getting the tropical getaway I'd been looking forward to. But I've bounced back now, and I'm happy to be here with you once again. We have yet another new link in our Top Spots widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. It's for mysomatotype.com, and it draws upon the work of Sheldon, who categorized us all into three primary body types, mesomorphs, endomorphs, and ectomorphs. And he asserted that there are personality types that correspond to those body types or somatotypes. MySomatotype.com will give you a personality reading based on your body type, which is in turn based on a photo that you submit to them. I've always been intrigued by Sheldon's typology personally. Check it out. Remember, our Top Spots widget is a place where you can post an ad for your services or product or podcast or blog for a mere $20 PayPal payment. And that ad will stay up for months and months. It may be the cheapest advertising you can find anywhere on the internet, as I've said before. So either consider posting your own ad or patronizing one of our listeners who have posted theirs, such as the person at mysomatotype.com. Every now and then we read a story in the newspaper about someone who has stuffed their house with newspapers or piles of junk or even cats, in a behavior known as hoarding. I was fascinated to learn that this is a variant of obsessive-compulsive disorder in my Wise Counsel interview with Dr. Gail Steckety at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. You'll want to check this one out. And by the way, I'm not sure I've mentioned it, but every one of my Wise Counsel interviews has a typed transcript available for free as well. So even if you don't have the time to listen, you might want to download the transcript and quickly scan through it for points of interest. Don't forget that in addition to iTunes, you can be listening to this podcast on your cell phone using Stitcher. To find out more, there's a link on our website, or you can go to Stitcher.com, and Stitcher is spelled S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. One use I put my time to in not going to Kauai was to repair Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 91, A Cross-Cultural Perspective on Dreams, with archaeologist Dr. Curtis Hoffman. I played a portion of this interview in my Myth, Dream, and Symbol class last semester, and I was horrified to discover that my voice was so faint in contrast to my guests that it was difficult, if not impossible, to hear my questions. Using the wonderful software package Bias Peak Pro 6, I was able to go in and raise the gain on my voice. Unfortunately, that episode was recorded before I started being able to put my guest and myself on separate audio tracks. So raising the gain was a very painstaking task of locating each place where I spoke and selecting just that portion of the waveform and raising the gain. So if you're interested in dreams, you might want to listen either for the first time or listen again to the new and improved version of episode number 91. If you haven't done so already, please add yourself to our Frapper map. You'll find a link on our site, or you can simply go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, and Frapper is spelled F-R-A-P-P-R. The conversation has picked up in our Yahoo discussion group, what with a couple of new members showing up there, and you can join it by using the banner link on our website in the right-hand sidebar, or you can simply send an email to shrinkwrapradio-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Thanks so much, those of you who've made a financial donation. And if you would like to make a donation to support this work, please look for the big green donate button on our site. And those also serve who patronize our sponsors using the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Budget Car Rentals, and Angie's List. You might notice that I'm not mentioning Brookstone. Their sponsorship, unfortunately, has expired. So I hope you took advantage of their discount while it was available. I know that many of you did.
Hi, my name is David Bradley. Come on over, have a seat. We'll make room. We're all friends here. All comfortable? All right. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, David Bradley, for that transition. You might recall that David is hosting a relatively new podcast called Psychoniclasm, spelled P-S-Y-C-O-N-O-C-L-A-S-M, in which he uses the interview format to explore controversial issues in psychology. His most recent episode is number 6, in which he explores the therapy known as EMDR, and I have to say he really knocked that one out of the park. So you'll definitely want to listen to that podcast episode. Once again, I'm running long, so I'll read just a few listener emails. First, we hear from Jari in Finland, who wrote to thank me for replying to one of his comments on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. And he writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, thanks for replying personally. I really appreciate it. Just like I appreciate all the work you do with your podcast, it really is an amazing resource and professionally done. Even though my major was computer science, I'm still very interested in all things psychological and actually minored in social psychology, too. My interest lies more in relationships between people than the inner workings of the brain. Keep up the good work. Sincerely, Jari." Thanks for that note, Jari. It's so wonderful to hear from far away Finland, way up in the North Country. Next one comes from longtime listener Paul up in Canada, who teaches philosophy there. And he writes, "Dear Dave, hope you're well. I just finished listening to the very interesting last episode of Shrink Wrap, which prompted me to write you about a few issues. I think you've an exceptional show. Don't worry about the show ratings. People are ravenous for podcasts these days, especially if they're free. And if the ranking of Shrink Wrap has fallen some, it reflects nothing as to the quality of your wonderful show. It only means that the show is less frequent than before. I've been a listener of your show since day one, I believe, and I'm fully aware of the tremendous amount of work you put into the show, from coordinating guests to research to conducting longer than average, though insightful and much appreciated interviews. I don't know of any podcast that is as generous in its duration and quality of content as yours. For this alone, you should be very proud. Finally, if I may, I would like to offer the suggestion that if the show goes biweekly, has it already? Yes, it mostly has. That topics be broader than usual. So, for example, instead of having a show on children with antisocial personality disorder, you have one on children and personality disorders. Maybe have one on the show and see what he or she says. Keep up the great work, Dave. Thank you for everything." And that's signed Paul, who adds a P.S. He says, "If I can help you research or organize shows in the future, please let me know what might be involved." So thank you very much for that generous offer, Paul, and for your kind comments and your long-standing support. And yes, the ranking of the show kind of moves up and down. Now that I'm in an every other week kind of flow here. And so it pops back up after I release a show, and then it kind of gradually sinks over the two weeks. But I'm not going to be too concerned about that. And because my shows are so focused on a single interview, I'm not sure how possible it would be to carry out your suggestion of going broader. It's real. The shows tend to be focused on the interviewee and their particular expertise. Finally, we hear from Sarah Zeldman, a former Shrink Wrap Radio guest in episode number 106, and coach and author of the Solutions for Busy Moms blog. Sarah writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm sure that Tal Ben-Shahar would make a great guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. I saw him on the Colbert Report a couple of years ago and have been following his work ever since. Funny, it actually turns out he knows my brother-in-law. Small world. It would be a perfect opportunity for him to promote his course. Your audience should be the perfect target market for him, and it would make a great show for you. Doesn't this course look awesome? Wish I could afford to take it, Sarah Zeldman." And she includes a quote at the end of her emails: "I am too positive to be doubtful, too optimistic to be fearful, and too determined to be defeated." And that's a great quote, Sarah, and a wonderful suggestion. I've been aware of Ben Tal Shahar as a teacher of a very popular course on happiness at Harvard. It was the most popular course there. Maybe it still is. And also, he authored a book on positive psychology. And so I have put him on my list as somebody to contact down the line and see if I can reel him in. He'd be one of the biggies. And I don't know if I can get him or not, but it's worth a try. Maybe you'd be able to facilitate the invitation through the connection of your brother-in-law. So I think that better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and that you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I am ShrinkPod, and you can also leave messages on our phone at 206-337-0622. I'd love to hear your voice. I don't get to hear enough voices. Thanks to my guest, Roger Kamenetz, for sharing his expertise and experience with archetypal dream work. My next show will be with therapist and author Leslie Davenport, and we'll be discussing her work using guided imagery. Now, please stay tuned for just a couple of brief sponsor announcements and possible discounts for you. And until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. Save money on your next car rental by going to avis.com/shrink. Avis tries harder with knowledge, caring, and a passion for excellence. You'll get 10% off or $30 off a weekly rental by going to avis.com/shrink. Or using the Avis link on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com. Next time you need someone to work on your home, repair your car, or fix your teeth, check Angie's List first. At Angie's List, you'll find thousands of unbiased ratings on hundreds of services. Just go to angieslist.com and use promo code SHRINK for 25% off your membership. Or you can go to the Angie's List link on our site under the Promos tab for more information.